It's Wednesday night, and our subject is the history of Israel. And I want to point out to you and emphasize, when you're reading the Bible, don't think that some little word or some word that seems to be unimportant is unimportant, because that's not true. Every word in the Bible can be studied in great detail. And the words that, when I was young, I used to be reading along, I think, oh gosh, I got to get to a more important word, a more important subject. And later on, I would begin to define that word and define the culture, and it would branch off into 100 different directions. We'll hit a couple of words like that tonight that you may think are unimportant, but they're not only not unimportant, they're extremely important. And they have great meaning and great effect upon the Scriptures. And I might just go ahead and write them down. One is the word hospitality. Hospitality. When we think of that word hospitality, we think of, well, okay, so what? Be nice to somebody when they come to your house. It's more than that to the Jews. Much more. And I want you to look at the word. Probably most of you have never even noticed these words to any degree. The word sojourner. A sojourner is a stranger in Israel, or someone who comes to Israel to visit them. And when they come, you are to use hospitality on these people. This has to do with the very subject that we're talking about this Levite who has a concubine that leaves, that goes down, and she is from Bethlehem. She is from Bethlehem down here. And he's living up here. His place of abode is up here in Ephraim. Now, Ephraim is divided in the middle by what they call Mount Ephraim. Up here north of Benjamin, here's Dan. And up here in the middle of Ephraim is some mountains here, and that is what they call Mount Ephraim, or kind of the headquarters for northern Israel. Because remember that Ephraim is the second-born son of Joseph, and Ephraim received the inheritance of all of northern Israel. Here's southern Judah. Benjamin and Judah comprise the southern kingdom. Simeon is numbered with the 10 northern tribes, because he certainly would be, without him, they'd only be 9. So he is numbered with the 10 northern tribes, and we've already gone through the reason why he was put down here in the middle of Judah, because he led this rebellion against Hamor and Shechem and had them murdered. So God separated him down here, and he scattered Levi all over Israel. And then we're talking about this man of Mount Ephraim that he goes down here and marries a woman in Bethlehem, and he heads back up to Ephraim, but he doesn't get there. He gets up here just to Gibeah, just about a few miles north of Jerusalem on his way back. And we're talking about an incident that happened there. Let's go back over to the 49th chapter of Genesis first. Now, God is showing us here. He's given us the... He's showing us the last will and testament of Jacob, whose name has been changed to Israel, over these 12 sons that he has. And he gives them either their blessings or their cursings. And he starts with Reuben. He was the firstborn. And he goes on, says he's unstable as water in the verse 3. Jacob is on his deathbed. He told Joseph to call all his brethren. They're all over there in Egypt. Joseph has procured all of his family to come to Egypt. And they go over there. And after they're there for some years, then it's time for Jacob to die. And Joseph will die in the next chapter. But it's going to be some years after Jacob, or after Israel dies. Reuben is his firstborn. And he kind of curses Reuben because he says, "You're unstable as water." He slept with his stepmother's handmaid, Bilhah, slept with Bilhah, had a sexual affair with her. Not only was he unstable with her, but he was unstable in everything he did. And then Simeon and Levi, there's a curse put upon them. Levi would be scattered. Simeon would be separated. And that's what happened to him, because they went together, or they cooperated in a rebellion, because Shechem wanted to have their sister Dinah, and he took her, and when he took her, he had sexual relations with her and lived in a house with her, and he said, "I want to marry your sister," and he told Jacob, "I want to marry your daughter," and he said, "That'll be fine. You have to convert over to our beliefs and be circumcised," and they said, "All right, that's what we'll do." And Simeon led this rebellion in going after they were circumcised, and they were too sore to move from their beds, and they went over, and Simeon told Levi, "Let's go over there and kill them." Simeon, I believe, was the leader in this rebellion, and that's why God separated Simeon down here and put him down here away from the rest of the tribes. Evidently, Simeon was a troublemaker. You're going to find that each one of these sons had a tribe, or they were a nation within themselves, and each one of them had an army. Now, as to why, I haven't discovered yet why God gave Manasseh such a big share, and he'd give Benjamin a small share, and Dan a small share, and Issachar and Zebulun a small share, and Naphtali a bigger share. I believe a lot of this is desert land. So Ephraim, the land of Ephraim, is a very rich land with rivers flowing through it and with the mountains in it. And they had snow there in the wintertime. So it's not like Israel was always a land of just guys walking around with turbans and robes and sandals on. It would get cold there during the winter. Well, we went on down through Simeon and Levi, and then down to Judah, his fourthborn, and out of Judah would come the king. He gives him that blessing. Then he skips all the way down to the tenthborn, down to Zebulun. Zebulun, I like to go ahead and say this again since I've got a good map. In verse 13, Zebulun will dwell at the haven of the sea, and he shall be for a haven of ships, and his border shall be into Sidon. As I've said before, there are no ships. There's no sea around Zebulun. There's no ships around Zebulun. And I believe what it's talking about is he. One thing we know, that Jesus was born down here in Judah, in Jerusalem. That shows that Jerusalem is inside Benjamin on this map. There's lots of contention about that. Usually most of the maps will show Jerusalem right on the border of Benjamin and Judah, just right there at the border. Now, Jesus was born in Jerusalem. Of course, Benjamin and Judah is southern Judah. Simeon is not southern Judah, even though it's in the middle of southern Judah. Simeon belongs with the 10 tribes up here. So when you think of them going to war, think of Simeon getting his soldiers, marching across the land, and going up and joining his brothers up here. So Jesus was born in Jerusalem, but he was raised in Zebulun, because Zebulun, in the bottom of Zebulun, is Nazareth. That's where he's raised. He lived 30 years in Zebulun. Then when the Bible says that, it speaks there and says, he shall dwell at the haven of the sea, Jesus moved his home here on the shores of northern Galilee, up here at Capernaum, which is right on the shores of northern Galilee. And when it says he'll be a haven for ships, the word ship means boats, and the boats of Peter, James, John, and Andrew, their boats were the fishing boats were up here, and he was a haven for the boats up here. You notice there's no sea here around Zebulun, but he moved his permanent home to Capernaum, and that has to be a type of Christ. And then it says, and his border shall be unto Sidon. Well, if you look in Matthew the 15th chapter and Mark the 7th chapter, the furthest Jesus ever preached away from Israel was up here in Sidon, and that's a foreign country. This right here is the country of what we call today Lebanon. This down here is this is the land of the Philistines. We call that the Gaza Strip. The West Bank is up here on the west bank of the Jordan River. It curls over here like this. It's the west bank of the Jordan River, and that's where the Philistines live, is in the West Bank and in the land of the Philistines, or the Gaza Strip. This was also the land of Anak, back when Moses tells the people, or God tells the people, to go over into the land of Anak. They encamp down here at Kadesh Barnea right here. They encamp at Kadesh, and they go into the land of the Anakims, which are the giants, and they come back and murmur against God, and God puts them in the wilderness for 40 years. So this is the picture of Israel. Here's the Mediterranean Sea here. And then you go up here, and you've got Syria up here, and then you're going over to Iraq, which is Babylon over in this area over here. And I'd like to have a map of all of it. Well, maybe we'll get all of it. Then he gets on down to the rest of his children, Issachar. Issachar is right here. Of course, Issachar doesn't like to fight. Each one of them has a personality. Each tribe has a personality, just like you go into various parts of the United States and you'll find personalities. If you go out in the Midwest, go out into Iowa, Kansas, you find real country people with simple attitudes and simple ideas. They don't know anything about big city life, big city living. Most of those people out there don't, unless they go to Kansas City, somewhere like that. If you get into certain areas, these were country people and very simple people right here. And you get into other areas, Benjamin was a fighting people. They were always in a fight for several reasons, and we'll get into that, why they were. One of the reasons could be, see, here's Gilgal right there. Gilgal is right in the center of Israel, right in the center of Israel. When Israel comes and they wander through the wilderness for 40 years and they come up here, this was the land of Moab in here, all this in here. Up here was the land of Ammon. And when they were fighting the Ammonites, what became the land of Manasseh and Gad and Reuben was Moab and Ammon. And today we call this area Jordan. So right east of Israel is Jordan, or the land of Gad, Reuben, and Manasseh. So this is Ammon over here. They show that. This Moab. But Moab took up more than just this down here. It took up all this, and Ammon took up all this up here. So that became the land of Jordan. Now, we're talking about, let's continue here, and then we go on to Dan. Dan was a fighting tribe, was also a judging tribe. The prophecies given about Dan are really probably concerning more Samson than any other person. Each one of these you can pick out and show that there's someone that God has specifically in mind. And he said Gad was a troop, and of course, a troop is a marching group of soldiers, so they were a fighting bunch of people. And a lot of this probably had to do with where they were located. And Asher, his bread shall be fat, and he shall yield royal dainties. So he's actually saying Asher will grow a lot of good crops, that he'll have a lot of... Of course, he's going to be right there by the sea. He's going to bring in a lot of fishermen are going to come in there. There are going to be a lot of docks along the way there and growing a lot of things. And Naphtali is a hind that is loose. He giveth goodly words. Very possibly this could mean that he giveth goodly words could be Jesus living in Capernaum, which is in Naphtali, giving the good words. That's where he begins preaching his ministry, at Capernaum. And that becomes Jesus' home. The Bible speaks of Jesus actually leaves Nazareth and adopts that as his home over there in Capernaum. That's just at the top of the Sea of Galilee. And then he speaks about, where was I? Asher, and then Naphtali, and then Joseph. He goes into Joseph, how Joseph is being blessed, particularly through his second-born son, Ephraim. And Ephraim will head up all the tribes of northern Israel. Anytime you see Ephraim referred to after the death of the man Ephraim, which is going to be there in Egypt, he's going to be in Egypt somewhere along the way in that 400-year period, he's going to die, but he has a tribe, and his tribe will be the leaders of northern Israel. Benjamin and Judah will be the tribes of southern Judah. Now, we get down to Benjamin. Let's read Benjamin again. Benjamin shall raven as a wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is it that their father spake unto them and blessed them, Everyone according to his blessing, he blessed them. And his cursing, we might add. Now, it speaks here about Benjamin being like a ravening wolf. I've said before, I've said it many times, that the wolves were the most feared animal of the sheep. More than a bear, more than a lion. Because a lion would pick up one little baby lamb, take off and eat it, and it was satisfied. A bear would come in, pick up one ewe lamb and take it off and devour it, and it was satisfied. But wolves would stand on the hilltop, maybe 10 or 12, in a pack, and they would look down and snarl and bare their teeth, and they'd go down in the middle of the night. If there were 100 sheep there, if there wasn't a shepherd guarding the sheep, they would slaughter 100 sheep and leave them dead on the ground and just leave. And the wolves just hated sheep. They had a natural averseness to sheep. So he's talking about Benjamin fighting like a wolf ravens, just with a ferocity. And that's what we're talking about. And I'm giving you an example of him over in Judges. The last story of Judges, Judges the 19th chapter, this is the last incident in the Bible before you go to the next book. When you leave the book of Judges, you go into Ruth. But the last incident of the book of Judges is about this, is about Benjamin's ability to fight. It starts off in the land of Ephraim. There's a Levite. Let's read here. It came to pass in those days there was no king in Israel. We read several places here in Judges. They didn't have kings yet. When did the kings begin? Does anybody remember? Huh? When did Israel get their first king? Say when?
First Samuel.
Do you remember the chapter?
The
12th. No, somewhere around that. Where did they ask for a king?
12.
8. 8 chapter. Where did they get one? 9 chapter. Yeah. And who was their first king?
Saul.
Yeah, there's the first king right up there, Saul. He was the first king of Israel. Not actually the first king, the first man king. God was their first king. The scripture says in Hosea 13, God was their king. And the scripture tells us in the 12th chapter of 1 Samuel, God was their king. And Jesus is the God of the Old Testament. He said before Abraham was, I am the God of the Old Testament. I am. And the Pharisees took up stones for him, calling himself the I am God of the Old Testament. He was the Jehovah of the Old Testament. Therefore, he was the king of the Jews. That's why he was called that when he came here. Now, we find a man here that's a Levite. He's sojourning on the side of Mount Ephraim. He is a sojourner also. Why would a Levite be called a sojourner? Is anybody, could you reason that out yourself?
They had no land.
They could be called anywhere in Israel. They could be, someone could say, I need a Levite over here in Manasseh, and he'd go over and live in Ramoth-Gilead. Or I need a Levite down here in Simeon, and he would go down there. So he was sojourning. He was a stranger, a sojourner here. So when we're talking about sojourning, this is what we're talking about. And we're talking about hospitality at the same time. Now, he goes down here. He's dwelling in Mount Ephraim. He goes down here to Bethlehem, and he finds him a concubine. A concubine is a secondary wife. It's not a first wife. It takes a lot of studying to go into, a lot of reading to get into this. I'm not going to go into it any further than that. She's called a secondary wife. You remember that Jacob had two wives. Who were they?
Leah, Rachel.
And who were the concubines? The concubines. Bilhah and Zilpah. If you have twins, name them Bilhah and Zilpah. And they'll really catch a lot of flack in school, won't they? And call them Billy and Zilly, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, he went down here and he found him a concubine. He got him a concubine from Bethlehem. And he brings her back and marries her. And she decides to apostatize from him. Now, you're going to find as we go through here, the Levite is a picture of God the Father. And you can find that the concubine is a picture of Old Testament Israel. Old Testament Israel. And Israel rejected Jehovah God, didn't they? They apostatized from God, and she apostatizes and goes back home to Bethlehem and leaves him and goes down here. And he goes back to get her. But if you'll notice in the reading of the text, she never is actually, she never really is repentant, is she? Doesn't say anything about her repentance. He forcibly brings her, heads back with her, and heads up towards Jerusalem. When he gets up here to Jerusalem, they do not want to go into Jerusalem, because he says the reason here in verse 10, and the man would not tarry that night, but he rose up and departed. Now they're on their way back to Mount Ephraim. They're going to go back up here. That's where the Levite's doing his work. He's going to get his apostate wife, and he's bringing her back, and he gets back towards Jerusalem, and he's not going to go in there because it's a pagan city at that time, and it's not even called Jerusalem. It's called Jebus. So, let's continue reading. But the man would not tarry that night, but he rose up and departed. Her father, the father of the concubine, kept begging him to stay here, and he kept him there for 5 days. And he said, no, it's time for me to go back. So he heads back, and he's headed back up to Mount Ephraim, this mountain range here. I don't know how long it is, but he heads back up, and he gets outside of Jerusalem on his way back up here, and came over against Jebus, which is Jerusalem, and there were with him 2 asses saddled. His concubine also was with him. And when they were by Jebus, which is Jerusalem, the day was far spent. It became Jerusalem later. We read that, how that David's nephew in 1 Chronicles 11, I believe it's verse 46, he conquers Jerusalem, he conquers Jebus, and they name it Jerusalem. So it doesn't become Jerusalem until many years later. When they were by Jebus, the day was far spent, and the servant said unto his master, come, I pray thee, and let us turn into this city of the Jebusites and lodge in it. And his master said unto him, we will not turn aside hither into the city of a stranger. Now, the reason he calls it a stranger, which is the same thing as a sojourner, a stranger. They're strangers to Israel because they are a pagan city. Why is the pagan city in the middle of Jerusalem, in the middle of Israel? And called Jebus. Why would any of these cities be pagan? We're going to find out that just north of Jerusalem is a town called Gibeah, and it's also, it is an Amorite city. What are these, and this, and Jerusalem is a Jebus city, or Jebusite city. Why is that? They were in Egypt for 400 years, but why are they still there when Israel comes in there? They didn't drive them out of there. And God tells them, drive all these pagans out, throw them out of the land. I gave it to Abraham 600 years earlier. It doesn't belong to them. Kick them out. Drive them out. I'll be with you with your armies. And you go in there and drive them out, and I will see to it you conquer them. But they didn't. They went in there and they started marrying them. They let them keep their cities. This is why when Saul becomes king of Israel, the first battle that Saul has with Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, Saul, God tells Samuel, you tell Saul, when it's time to fight one of these battles, here's the Ammonites up here. In the land of Ammon, the city of Ammon is up, Ammon, Jordan is right up here about where this Kamon is. I guess it'd be maybe A-M-O-N, Kamon. Probably that's the same spot. That's about where Ammon, Jordan is. That's the capital city. Well, this was Ammon up here. And when he was fighting the Ammonites, I was going to give you something. I forgot what it was.
First battle.
His first battle. When Saul went up there, He was going to fight these Ammonites. I was going to give you something about it, not thinking about what it was.
He was supposed to wait.
Oh, he's supposed to wait.
Yeah.
He wanted the right eyes of the people. He was supposed to wait. He was supposed to go to Gilgal and wait. The reason he was supposed to go to Gilgal is because Gilgal is the center city of all the cities here in Israel. You notice it's halfway between here and here, up here, and here down to here. That's because it's right in the center of Israel. And God says to Samuel, you tell Saul to go to Gilgal and wait till you get there. Wait 7 days. Of course, Saul didn't wait 7 days. Saul went ahead and got a priest to offer a sacrifice without Samuel being there. And that's in the 13th chapter. And because Saul got real upset because he saw thousands, maybe 100,000 of the Ammonites gathering around him at this great battle in the 11th chapter. And he didn't wait. He didn't want to wait for, well, actually the waiting happened in the 13th chapter when he's not fighting the Ammonites, but when he's fighting the Philistines. He got surrounded and he didn't want to wait for them. So he jumps the gun. He doesn't wait for Samuel to get there. He starts offering sacrifices before he gets there. Samuel gets there and says, you don't want to do what God says, so we're going to take the kingdom from you. So Gilgal is the place they were supposed to. The reason for Gilgal, gathering the armies at Gilgal, let me just say this. The reason for gathering the armies of Gilgal is because you had cities like Jerusalem and like Gibeah all over Israel with pagan enemies of Israel in these cities. So the whole idea was to have a mustering point. When you muster an army together, you gather them all together in one place and you bring them all to attention. You set them up in their ranks and in their companies and you march them against the enemy. This was the place they would do that, since that was a center, and they would send messengers out. We're going to war. Get over here to Gilgal. We're going to war. We're going to war. We're going to war. That's what Gilgal was for, so they could send the word out, not to the cities that were pagan, like Jerusalem and Gibeah, but the cities that were their brothers, that they were there. And this has everything to do with this story. Now let's continue this. Let me get a drink of water. If you don't know about Israel coming in and not driving everybody out, it messes up the whole Bible story from there on out, all the way through Israel's history. Who knows that? Who knows this? Why? I was telling a lady about this day. She said, "Well, I've read Judges, and I don't even remember that story." I said, "Well, it's there." Now. And when they were by Jebus, verse 11, the day was far spent, and the servant said unto his master, "Come up, pray thee, let us turn into this city of the Jebusites and lie there." And his master said unto him, "This is the man who's married to the concubine." She doesn't have a word to say about it. She's just standing there listening to the conversation. Notice there's not a word from her. "We will not turn aside hither into the city of a stranger. This is not of the children of Israel. We will pass over to Gibeah." But Gibeah's not of Israel either. I don't know. I don't understand the reasoning behind this, because Gibeah is just as pagan as Jerusalem. Gibeah was the hometown of King Saul. "We will pass over to Gibeah. And he said unto his servants, come and let us draw near to one of these places to lodge all night in Gibeah or in Ramah. And they passed on and went their way, and the sun went down upon them when they were by Gibeah, which belongeth to Benjamin." It belongs to Benjamin. Gibeah is a Benjamin city. It's just a few miles above Jerusalem, just about 4 or 5 miles above Jerusalem. But it's not a Christian city. It's not an Israelite city. Look over here in 2 Samuel 21. Look at 2 Samuel 21. I got to show this to you and show you it's not a city that's aligned with Israel. 2 Samuel 21. Now we're getting at the end of David's life. He's already had his affair with Bathsheba. Abishai has already tried to take over the kingdom. And everything's in a... And David is running for his life from Saul. Of course, Abishai died in 1 Samuel. And Saul is trying to chase David, run him down. And here in chapter 21, verse 1, "Then there was a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, 'It is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites.'" He went home and slew the people of his own hometown. I wonder why. We'll read the next verse. "And the king called the Gibeonites and said unto them..." Now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. And the children of Israel had sworn unto them, and Saul sought to slay them in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah. Now, let's get back over here. "Which belongeth to Benjamin." So they're just going north of Jerusalem. And these are Amorites that live in this city. "And they turned aside thither to go in and to lodge in Gibeah." Now, you know what comes to my mind immediately when I'm reading the Bible? If you don't read the Bible much, you're not going to be thinking of sojourner, hospitality. That goes through my mind when I'm reading something about a man traveling. I got to thinking, I need to look up the word hospitality and see what it's talking about. "And they turned aside and gathered thither to go in and to lodge in Gibeah. And when he went in, he sat down in a street of the city, for there was no man that took them into his house to lodging." You think this is a very serious act in Israel? To take somebody in and to treat them hospitable was a law in Israel. In fact, when you took somebody in, you had to guard them with your life. You had to protect them as though they were your own family. In fact, you would sacrifice anything in your household before you would allow anything to happen to the guest in your household that you took in. Once you opened the door, once you took them in, once they crossed the threshold, the threshold of a house was the altar at the beginning. The threshold of the house was very, very important. That's where they used to offer the sacrifices. That is why God had the Israelites put the blood upon the doorpost and the lintels of the doorpost, above the doorpost, because the threshold was the altar. That's where they would offer sacrifices before they had an altar. That was so that any stranger that come in and you didn't step up on the threshold. If you stepped up on the threshold, that has worked its way to America with little children walking down the street and say, "Step on a crack, you break your mother's back." That's where this actually began. "And behold, there came an old man from his work out of the field, and even which was also of Mount Ephraim. He sojourned in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjamites. And when he had lifted up his eyes, he saw the wayfaring man." I am a poor wayfaring stranger, wandering through this world too low. That's where they get that song, "Wayfaring Stranger." We are just pilgrims. We're wandering through this world. And the Lord reminds Israel constantly, you were strangers in Egypt and you were treated wrong. And he laid down this law when Moses went up on the mountain. You have to treat these people as though your very own family. And you will sacrifice your family for you allow a visitor in your household to die. That's what this man is going to do. It doesn't seem to make sense when you read it at first. And he saw a wayfaring man in the street of the city. And the old man said, "Whither goest thou, and whence camest thou?" And he said unto him, "We are passing from Bethlehem, Judah, toward the side of Mount Ephraim. From thence am I, and I went to Bethlehem, Judah, but I am now going to the house of the Lord, and there is no man that receiveth me into his house." Let me read something to you First of all, let me read something out of the book of Leviticus. Go to Leviticus, the 19th chapter and verse 33. You won't understand this unless you get a hold of this right here. 19, verse 33. Now, this is the law, isn't it? Isn't Leviticus the law? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy? Verse 33. "If a stranger sojourn with thee in your land, you shall not vex him, rage or violence toward him, or maltreat him." Now, the Jews took this as a commandment to bring them in and to nourish them as their own family. "But the stranger that dwelleth with you shall be unto you as one born among you." He's going to be like your brother or your sister. Once he moves into the house with you and eats with you, he is family. And you don't let anything happen to him. You sacrifice anything in the family before anything will happen to this stranger. "And thou shalt love him as thyself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." And if you don't understand the law of hospitality, and look over here in Leviticus 25. You have to understand this before you even understand the chapter. Leviticus 25 and verse 35. "And if thy brother be waxen poor or fallen in decay with thee, then thou shalt relieve him. Yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with thee. Thou shalt take no usury of him." That means excessive interest or interest rates in a loan or increase. "But fear thy God, that thy brother may live with thee. Thou shalt not give him thy money upon usury, nor lend him thy victuals for increase. You give it to him. I am the Lord your God, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God." Now look back here at chapter 23. We're still in the law, aren't we? Chapter 23 of Exodus, excuse me, not Leviticus. Chapter 23 of Exodus. Chapter 23. Look here, verse 6. "Thou shalt not rest the judgment of thy poor in his cause." The word rest means to twist or pervert the judgment of the poor. You don't cheat somebody and then justify yourself for having cheated them, especially the poor people. "Keep thee far from a false matter, and the innocent and righteous slay thou not, for I will not justify the wicked." And he talks all through here about how we're to look out for the stranger. We're to take care of the needy and the poor. The greatest indictment against Israel was because they oppressed the poor and the needy. They did that because they didn't want to pay God what belonged to him. They didn't want to keep the sabbatical years. They didn't want to lose any money. They couldn't reap all of their harvest. They had to leave the gleanings for the poor. They couldn't shake their olive trees but once. Hospitality was the name of it. Remember, this comes to me and hits me over here in 2 Corinthians. Look here in 2 Corinthians, the 13th chapter. This was the law of Israel. 13. Second Corinthians. "This is the third time I'm coming to you in the mouth of two or three witnesses. Shall every word be established?" Wait, I'm reading the wrong verse. Excuse me. I mean Hebrews. I get the two mixed up. Hebrews, the 13th chapter. Sometimes I'll say one instead of the other. Let brotherly love continue. Be not forgetful to entertain strangers. Stranger is the word philonexia. Philonexia. It is a derivative of philos and xenos, xenos. Xenos is the word stranger, and it means to have an affection for strangers. Now, the only reason a stranger is going to be among us is because they're going to be saying that they believe what we believe. Strangers will not come to visit when they don't believe our truth. This is talking about people that are from some other area that believe these truths. Or if someone comes in that they haven't been here before and they don't know us, they're brothers and sisters if they're believing the truth like we are. Entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Now, a lot of people have taken this to believe that literal heavenly beings are walking around in human bodies, and that might be an angel. That's not what it's talking about. What angel is angelos, A-G-G-E-L-O-S. That's the common Greek word, messenger. What that's saying, some stranger that's coming to you, around you, that believes the truth, might be the messenger of God for your life that's going to give you some instruction of what to do. They're not going to come around bossing you, but in some situation that you get into with them, that you may be led into a certain area of service to God that you don't even know. So whenever new people come in, or even the people that are here, we're supposed to be hospitable to one another. We're not supposed to be complaining and griping and gossiping about one another. We are brothers and sisters. We all got peculiarities. We'll have different ways about us, but we're supposed to be loving one another, are we? That's what this is talking about. Now let's go back over here to this man. Well, let me give you something else on this hospitality. Let me just give you something on this first. We find this man, he's sojourning, and he can't find anybody to take him in. This was a law among the Jews to be hospitable. Let me read this to you. Hospitality. This comes out of McClintock and Strong. The practice of receiving strangers in one house and giving them suitable entertainment may be traced to early origin of human society. It was practiced, as it still is, among the least cultivated nations. With the Greeks, hospitality was under the immediate protection of religion. Jupiter bore a name, Kazinos. That's another name for Jupiter, stranger. Kazinos, signifying that its right were under his guardianship. Strangers were in the guardianship of even Jupiter among the pagan gods. This was a quality of mercy that spread throughout the world, even among the pagans, to be hospitable. In the Odyssey, we are told expressly that all guests and poor people are special objects and care to the gods. That's why Jesus tells Moses to tell the children of Israel, if you oppress the widow and the orphan, and they cry unto me, I will hear their cry, and I will kill you with a sword, Kenneth Copeland. He didn't put that part in. He said, I'll kill you with a sword, and your sons and daughters will be orphans. Your wife will be a widow after I get through casting you into hell. There were both in Greece and Italy two kinds of hospitality, the one private, the other public. The first existed between individuals. The second was cultivated by one state towards another. Hence rose a new kind of social relation between those who had exercised and partaken of the rights of hospitality. An intimate friendship ensued, which was called into play whenever the individuals might afterwards chance to meet and the right duties and advantages of which passed from father to son were deservedly held in the highest estimation. Hospitality has nowhere been more early or more fully practiced than in the East. That's the word Oriental. Oriental means East. Occidental. We are Occidentals. We're in the West. It is still honorably observed among the Arabs, especially at the present day. An Arab, on arriving at a village, dismounts at the house of someone who is known to him, saying to the master, "I am your guest." On this, the host receives the traveler and performs his duty. That is, he sets before his guest his supper, consisting of bread, milk, and borgul, one of their foods. And if he is rich and generous, he also takes the necessary care of his horse or beast of burden. Should the traveler be unacquainted with any person, he alights at any house, as it may happen, fastens his horse to the same, proceeds to smoke his pipe until the master bids him welcome and offers him his evening meal. In the morning, the traveler pursues his journey, making no other return than "God be with you." The early existence of long continuance of this amiable practice in Oriental countries are owing to the fact of their presenting that condition of things which necessitates and calls forth hospitality. What population is thinly scattered over a great extent country and traveling is comparatively infrequent, inns or places of public accommodation are not found. That's why we find so much of this in the scripture. Whenever they were traveling, when Jesus was bringing Mary down to Bethlehem and there was no place in the inn, they were supposed to bring him in and find some place for Joseph and Mary. That was the law of the Jews. Let me give you something else here. Before finishing this, you'll understand what this is about. Let me show you something. The threshold was the place they offered their early offerings. Look over here in Zephaniah, the first chapter. Zephaniah. Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. That's the last four books of the Old Testament. Zephaniah, the first chapter. Zephaniah, the first chapter, is talking about when Jerusalem is invaded by the Babylonians and they come in to slaughter them. Look here in verse 4. "I will stretch out mine hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem." We're all familiar with that. I've taught on that so much. What Zephaniah is talking about is when they come in, he's prophesying around 630 B.C., but Jerusalem doesn't fall till 586. Now, how does Zephaniah know this? He's a prophet. I thought I'd ask you that trick question. Yeah. He's a prophet of God. He knows what's going to happen. "I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place." Everybody here knows what Zephaniah is talking about here, don't we? It's real simple when you've heard me preach. Because Israel went after Baal in the grove for 500 years. And God said, "I'll send sword, famine, pestilence, then I'll send the beast in to carry you away." So Zephaniah is talking about Babylon being overrun by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. And the name of the Chemarims with the priests, and those were the people who worked around the temple, and them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops, and them that worship and that swear by the Lord and swear by Malcolm, which is another name for Molech, and them that are turned back from the Lord, and those that have not sought the Lord nor inquired of him. Now he's talking about Nebuchadnezzar coming in, isn't he? We're still talking about hospitality and the threshold of God. "Hold thy peace at the presence of the Lord God, for the day of the Lord is at hand. For the Lord hath prepared a sacrifice, he hath bid his guest. And it shall come to pass in the day of the Lord's sacrifice that I will punish the princes of Israel and the kings of Israel's children and all such as are clothed by strange apparel. And in the same day also will I punish all those that leap on the threshold, which fill their master's houses with violence and deceit." And when the Bible says, "Thou shalt not vex a stranger," it means to be violent towards them or maltreat them. He's saying, "I'm going to bring in some that will jump up and down on the threshold upon what was the early altar of God." Here's a book. I don't necessarily agree with the man's theology all the time, but he knows something. His name is H. Clay Trumbull. This is the Threshold Covenant. Let me read you just a little bit out of this. Because when you find this woman being cast out into the streets, it's like a picture of reversed hospitality to her because she's not repentant. She's a picture of Israel that's unrepentant. Read something to you out of this threshold covenant. The primitive altar of the family would seem to have been the threshold or the door sill or the entranceway. Sacrifices for the family were therefore within or at the entrance of the family domicile or the entrance into the house. A guest who is worthy of special honor is to be welcomed to the home. The blood of a slaughtered or sacrificed animal is shed on the threshold of that home as a means of adopting the newcomer into the family. When you brought someone in, he was a part of the family even after he was gone. The host takes a lamb or a goat and tying its feet together, lays it upon the threshold of his door, resting his left knee upon the bound victim. The host holds his head by his left hand, while with his right he cuts his throat. He retains his position until all the blood has flowed from the body upon the threshold. Then the victim is removed, and the guest steps over the blood across the threshold. He doesn't step on the threshold. Remember, keep in mind, the Lord had him put the blood upon the doorpost. That was the altar before they had an altar in the temple. And we're the house of God only. The guest steps over the blood across the threshold, and in this act he becomes, as it were, a member of the family of the threshold covenant. And God is saying, I'm going to cause the Babylonian to come in and trample your thresholds. He won't be a welcome guest into the house. You see, every one of these little words means something. The flesh of the slaughtered animal is usually given to the neighbors, although in a case of humbler persons, it is sometimes used for the meal of the guest in whose honor it is sacrificed. As illustrative of this idea, a story is commonly told in Syria of a large-hearted man who gave proof of his exceptional devotedness. He had a horse which he prized, as only an Oriental can prize and love one. This horse he sent to meet his guest in order that he might bring him to the home of its owner. When the guest reached the house and dismounted, he spoke warm words in praise of the noble animal. At once the host led the horse to the house door and cut its throat over the threshold, asking the guest to step over the blood of this costly offering. If you know that one is coming whom you would honor and welcome, you must make ready to have the blood on the threshold when he appears. Crossing the threshold or entering the door of a house is in itself an implied covenant, and the people in the town of Gibeah knew that. They knew taking him in. So this man is sitting in the streets with no one to bring him in. It's like people don't want Christ in the house. Do they? I was talking to several people today. I said, people are not interested in the truth in America. I have resolved that. I don't get depressed over it so much. I'd get depressed, but not permanently. I just say, well, they don't want it. They don't care. It's an implied covenant for those who therein. He who goes in by the door must count himself. And didn't Jesus say, I am the door of the sheep? Why do you think he placed himself as the door? Everything has an exact meaning down to the finest points and must be recognized as a guest subject to the strictest laws of hospitality. And if he enters the house in some other way, he's a thief and a robber, Jesus said. Not crossing the threshold, there is no such implied covenant on his part. That's why Jesus said, anybody who enters in any other way besides the door, and you don't step on me when you come in. The threshold, there is no implied covenant in his part. He may then even despoil or kill the head of the house. He has entered without any breach of law of hospitality if he gets in the house any other way than through the door. And he can't step up on the threshold. That one may enter his foe's house, not by the door. And that's why Jesus said in John 10, talking about the parable of the good shepherd, I am the door. If you enter any other way, you're a thief and a robber. He brings this out in the book here. I am the door. Scandinavians primitive Scandinavians of attacking the inmates of an enemy's house through the roof instead of the door, also of the customs of the Greek of visiting a victor in Olympian games in his city through a breach in the walls instead of causing him to enter by the gates with its implied subjection to all the laws of hospitality. Examples of the blood welcome at the threshold abound in modern Egyptian customs. At the entrance of the palace, six buffaloes were slaughtered, two being killed. Just as the Khedive's carriage reached the gateway, the blood of the animals was splashed across the entrance. When General Grant was at Assiut on the Upper Nile during his journey around the world, he was doubly welcomed by a guest by the American vice consul, who was a native of Egypt. A bullock was sacrificed at the steamer landing, and its head was laid on one side of the gangplank and its body on the other. This was very sacred to these people there. The outpoured blood was between the head and the body under the gangland, so that in stepping from the steamer to the shore, General Grant would cross over it. When he reached the house of the vice consul, a sheep was similarly sacrificed at the threshold in such a way that General Grant passed over the blood in entering. It is also said in Egypt, if you buy a dihabia and therefore are to cross its threshold for the occupancy of your new home on the water, you must kill a sheep, letting the blood flow on the deck or the side of the boat in order that it may be lucky. Well, we don't believe in that. I'm just simply showing you the customs. There seems indeed to be a survival of this idea of custom of christening a ship at the time of its launching in England and America, a bottle of wine, the blood of the grape, being broken on the bow of the vessel as it crosses the threshold of the deep. In Central Africa, a new king is welcomed at the royal palace with a bloody threshold offering. Before he enters his palace, two men are to be slain, one at the foot of the tree by which his house is chiefly supported, the other at the threshold of his door, which is besmeared with the blood of the victim. Receiving an honored guest with bread and salt at the threshold of the house he enters is common in Russia. Bread and salt are symbolic in primitive thought of flesh and blood. This threshold welcome seems to be a survival of the threshold sacrifice. To step over or across the blood or its substitute on the door sill is to accept or ratify the pro-offered covenant. You have to step over a cross. What did he say that the Babylonians do that come in? They would defile the threshold of the houses. They were not going to be welcome guests when they were slaughtering Israel. But to trample upon the symbol of the covenant is to show contempt for the host who proffers it. And no greater indignity than this is known in the realm of primitive social intercourse. The threshold as the family altar on which the sacrifice of blood of a covenant welcome is poured out is counted sacred and is not to be stepped upon or passed over lightly. It is to be crossed over reverently. On passing the threshold in Arabia, I hope you understand why Jesus said, "I am the door." When you see that word threshold there and the Babylonians come in and trample on the threshold, that means they are not welcome. And they're transgressing the covenant of God when they trample the threshold. The threshold was the early altar before they had a temple, before Solomon built the temple. Before they had a tabernacle in the wilderness, the threshold was the altar. When you went into the house, that showed there was a blood covenant with God. On passing the threshold in Arabia, it is said that Bismillah, that is, in the name of God. In Syria, the belief prevails that it is unlucky to tread on the threshold. The caliphs of Baghdad required all who entered their palace to prostrate themselves on the threshold of the gate where they had inserted a fragment of the black stone. The threshold was of some height, and it was a crime to set foot on it. It was against the law too. Among the Hindus, the threshold is sacred. In private houses, it is not propitious for a person to remain on it, neither to eat, sneeze, yawn, or spit whilst there. You couldn't do any of that while you're on the threshold. A double welcome is sometimes given to one who is in an official position. Thus, a Syrian who held a commission from a chief officer of customs in Upper Syria was surprised at having two sheep sacrificed before him as he approached the door of a house east of the Sea of Galilee. To shake hands across the threshold instead of crossing it is said in Finland to ensure a quarrel. To step over a threshold in Lapland to bring one under protection of a family within and its guardian deity. See, even among the pagans, they believe the same thing in Israel. They probably got it from Israel. In Europe and America, it is by many counted an ill omen to tread upon a threshold of a door or enter a house. To the present day, in the portions of Scotland, the idea properly prevails that to tread directly upon the boundary lines of division between ordinary flagstones is to endanger one's soul. Hence, the very children are careful to avoid stepping upon these lines or stepping on a crack, or they'll break their mother's back. That's where that comes from. And they're walking across courtyards or along the streets in their everyday passing. Many a person in the United States who knows nothing of any superstition connected with this avoids, if possible, stepping on instead of over the cracks or seams of a board walk or even seams of a carpet. All these customs seem to be a survival of the feeling that the threshold is as sacred as the primitive altar. He goes on and on. In the building of private houses and well-lit temples and city gateways in ancient Assyria, images of various kinds and sizes in bronze, red, jasper, yellow stone, and baked earth are buried beneath the stones of threshold so as to bar the entrance of all destructive spirits. Invocations are graven upon these figures that it was the blood poured out at the threshold which was the essential act of covenanting in this sacrifice to Osiris. And it goes on and on. Read one other thing. It's interesting. Among the province of Bombay at the time of birth of a child, an iron crowbar is placed along the threshold of the room of confinement as a check against the crossing of evil spirit. This is in accordance with Hindu belief that evil spirits keep aloof from iron. And even nowadays, pieces of horseshoe can be seen nailed to the bottom sills of the doors of native houses. And when you go to Texas, they put up horseshoes over doors for luck. You realize how far back all this goes? So when you're talking about hospitality, you're talking about this woman, this man, not being welcomed into a house, and then the man casting his concubine out to the heathens. She evidently, well, we'll see it in a minute, she evidently was unrepentant. And she was willing to leave him, and he went to pursue her to get her and to take her back to Mount Ephraim. Let's go back over here to, we're talking about Benjamin being fighting like a wolf. What verse was I in? Huh? 19. No man received him into his house, and yet there is both straw and provender for our asses, and there is bread and wine also for me and for thy handmaid and for the young man which is with thy servants. There is no want of anything. And the old man from verse 16 that came out and said he would take these people in, the old man said, peace be with thee. Howsoever, let all thy wants lie upon me, only don't set out here in the streets. He's telling the man with his concubine and with his servants, don't stay out here in the streets. Come and lodge with me. So he brought him into his house and gave provender unto the asses, and they washed their feet and did eat and drink. Now, as they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, certain sons of Belial. Remember, the two sons of Eli were called sons of Belial. It means worthless. Wow. These sons of worthlessness beset the house round about and beat at the door and spake to the master of the house, the old man that owned the house that brings in the Levite and his concubine and servants, and saying, bring forth the man out of your house that we may have sexual relations with him, that we may know him. What are we reminded of here? Lot in Sodom and Gomorrah in the 19th chapter of Genesis. They were taken into a house too. the hospitality of Lot was given to them as these two angels came down to Lot's house in Sodom and Gomorrah, and these men gathered around the house and said, bring these men out that we may know them. And what was it Lot said?
Go into my daughters.
I've got two daughters. You can have them. He's going to... You see, this... You say, that doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't have to make sense to you. They would sacrifice their family before they would sacrifice strangers. Strangers who believe the same thing they believe, there was an obligation according to the law to take care of the strangers at any sacrifice. Lot said, I'll give you my daughters, and they've never been married, and he lied about that. Of course, he had been vexed with these conversation of these pagan men in Sodom. He wasn't exactly true in everything he was saying because they both had husbands. You remember that? So it reminds us of Lot being hospitable to these two angels. Of course, the two angels struck the men blind outside the house. The two angels were probably Michael and Gabriel, since the middle man was Jesus. And by the way, in the 18th chapter of Genesis, wasn't Abraham hospitable? When these three men showed up and he bowed down to the middleman and said, come in here, let me feed you, let me house you, let me... Everywhere you find this in the Old Testament, this happened constantly. Every time a man would come, they say, you've got to eat, you've got to stay with us. You remember when the Levite left the house of the concubine's father, he kept saying, stay another night, stay another night, stay another night, stay here, let me feed you, let me take care of you. That was the hospitality of the Jews. They believed that above anything, and they would sacrifice anything in the house before they would let a visitor in the house be hurt or any harm done to him or be mistreated. That's why Lot was willing to give his daughters, because that was the law of the Jews. That doesn't make sense to us. It doesn't have to make sense to us. That's the way the Jews believe it, and the same thing's going to happen here. You think, how could this man do what he did? He says here in verse 24, behold, here is my daughter, and here is this Levite's concubine. You can have them. But you can't have this man of God. I'm taking care of him. His concubine, them will I bring out now. We think that is a horrible, terrible thing. Not according to the law of the Jews. We don't think like God thinks. We don't even think like the Jews thought back then. The way they thought and the way they talked was completely different than us.
She wasn't considered a sojourner or a guest.
Well, she was from Bethlehem. He had a holy man in his house. He had a man of God. He had a Levite there. They wanted the Levite to be brought out there. Now, you got to remember, they've had some conversation up to now, haven't they? Had some conversation. The woman never shows any repentance. She's still an apostate mind. He's just forcing her to come back home. But she doesn't want to come back. This is God. Picture of God. The concubine is a picture of apostate Israel. And I'll show you that in a minute, why it's a picture of apostate Israel. Let's continue reading. And humble ye them, and do with them what seemeth good unto you, but unto this man of God, do not so a vile thing. He's not so concerned about the concubine. She has been rebellious all along. We don't see any repentance. We don't see a word from her. And the man is saying, you want this apostate woman, you want this woman who's ready to leave her husband. You can have her. You can have my daughter, but you can't have this man. He's a godly, holy man. He's going to protect the preacher at all cost. But the men would not hearken unto him, so the man took his concubine and brought her forth unto them. He brings his concubine out to them, and they knew her and abused her all the night until the morning. They raped her all night long. And when the day began to spring, or it began to dawn, they let her go. Then came the woman in the dawning of the day and fell down at the door of the man's house where her lord was. She comes back to the old man's house. where her Lord, her husband, is till it was light. And when the Levite, the Lord, her Lord, this is the Levite from Mount Ephraim that we started off the chapter with, when her Lord rose up in the morning and opened the doors of the house, went out to go his way, behold, the woman, his concubine, was fallen down at the door of the house, and her hands were upon the threshold. It's amazing, isn't it? Why would God keep mentioning this threshold? She was defiling the threshold, wasn't she? She didn't... I don't know if she didn't care, if she's too weak to know. It's a very serious thing. And he was going to sacrifice her before he had let the man of God be sacrificed to them and perform this defiling sin. She fell down, and her Lord rose up in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go out his way. And behold, the woman, his concubine, was fallen down at the door of the house, and her hands were upon the threshold. And he said unto her, up and let us be going. But none answered. She was dead. He said, get up and let's go. We got to go back. Evidently, she was raped and beaten to the point of dying the next morning. This is a picture of Israel who's apostate from God, and God is ready and willing to turn her over to the world that she wants to be with, and this is what happens to God's people when they do this. And Israel, in a sense, was a concubine because she was never obedient to God. She was more or less a secondary wife. God says his New Testament church or spiritual Israel will be obedient to him, and he will do that after he whips us and scourges us. Then the man took her up on an ass. The man rose up and got him into his place. And when he was come to his house, he took a knife and laid hold on his concubine and divided her together with her bones into 12 pieces and sent her into all the coasts of Israel. You know what I believe he did? Sent one piece to each tribe of Israel. There's 12 tribes. And it was so that all that saw it said, there was no such deed done as nor seen from the day that the children of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt unto this day. Consider it, take advice, and speak your minds. There was something similar done to that. Go back to 1 Kings. Go over to 1 Kings, not back. Go forward to 1 Kings. 1 Kings. Go to that 11th chapter. What he's doing is scattering Israel. Remember, Israel is going to be scattered after 500 years. 500 years going after Baal in the grove, being an apostate wife. God said, I'm going to give you a bill of divorce in Jeremiah the 3rd chapter. I am married unto you, and I'm giving you a divorce. But he says, when I divorce you, I'm going to send the sword, the famine, the pestilence, the first three judgments, then I'm going to send the beast, and I'm going to scatter all 12 tribes all over the world. Isn't that what he did? At the hands of Assyria? In 722 B.C., he scattered the 10 northern tribes. 22 B.C., 586 B.C., he scattered southern Judah. We'll look over here in 1 Kings, the 11th chapter. Now, in the 11th chapter, Solomon apostatizes and allows his wives, and Israel begins to apostatize here. He allows them to go after. He has got 700 wives and 300 concubines. He allows them to go after all of their sun gods, their Chemosh, their Molech, their Ashtaroth, and all the other gods and goddesses, the tree goddesses, the sun gods of Israel. And he says, I'm going to split the kingdom just for this, and I'm going to take the inheritance of northern Israel away from Israel. I'm going to take the 10 northern tribes away, and Ephraim's going to be head of that. And Ephraim has the inheritance of Israel, according to the 48th chapter of Genesis. And I'm going to leave Judah as a southern tribe, and later on Benjamin will join Judah as a part of the southern kingdom. But the inheritance belongs to northern Israel. So this is where he splits the inheritance belongs to northern Israel, and the king will come out of southern Judah. They'll be brought back together at the end of time. Well, notice what he does. He says, I'm taking the kingdom out of the hand, but I won't take it out of your hand while you're alive, Solomon. I'll take it out of the hand of your son Rehoboam. Well, in this chapter, we see that Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, becomes king, and that Rehoboam takes some bad advice from his high school buddies, and they tell him, you tell these old men that tell you to be easier on them and quit taxing them so much, you tell them that you're going to chastise them with scorpions, that your father chastised with whips. And to chastise with scorpions means to overtax them. Well, why was Solomon overtaxing the people? To build the temple. He wasn't just an honorary mean king. They didn't understand what was going on. Well, you get on down into this chapter, and Jeroboam, these old men come to Jeroboam, the commanding general for Rehoboam. Just because their names sound alike don't mean they're brothers. Jeroboam is the commander of Rehoboam's army. So the old men go to Jeroboam and they say, we want you to lead us. We're going to come and join you in northern Israel. Rehoboam gets the word on this, so Rehoboam with southern Judah is going to attack northern Israel with all of its tribes. Well, the prophet of the Lord comes to Rehoboam and tells him, this is of the Lord. I split this. Look down here in verse 26. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephrathite, he's from Ephraim of Zereda, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow woman, even he lifted up his hands against King Rehoboam. And this was the cause that he lifted up his hand against the king. Solomon built Milo and repaired the breaches, the city of David, his father. And the man Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor, and Solomon, seeing the young man, that he was industrious, he made him ruler over all the charge of the house of Joseph. And it came to pass at that time, when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, that the prophet Ahijah, the Shilonite, found him along a highway somewhere, along the road. And he had clad himself with a new garment, and they two were alone in a field out there together. Here's this commander that's going to lead the 10 northern tribes. And Ahijah caught the new garment that was on him, and rent it in 12 pieces. The woman is cut up into 12 pieces and sent throughout Israel. And he said to Jeroboam, take thee 10 pieces. You're going to lead the 10 northern tribes. Take 10 pieces. For thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will rend the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and will give 10 tribes unto you. And he shall have one tribe for my servant David's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, the city which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, because that they have forsaken me. The same thing that happened over there with the concubine. Anytime you find 12 pieces of anything in the Bible, that's a reference to the church or Israel. There were 12 tribes. There were 12 apostles. There were 12 baskets full of bread taken up in John the 6th chapter so that none would be lost. And 12 is the number of the complete church. There were 144,000 in the 14th chapter of Revelation, these being the first fruits, and these being the first fruits of God, And of his own will begat he us, that we might be a kind of first fruits. Those first fruits are the church or Israel or spiritual Israel. So wherever you find 12, that's Israel. That's a picture of Israel being scattered for apostasy, isn't it? The reason God put this in here with Benjamin in that 19th and 20th chapters is it's showing a picture of the apostasy of Israel when the man cuts the concubine up and she's an apostate wife and scatters her throughout all of Israel. I believe he sent one piece to every tribe. It's the same thing as this garment here being torn up into 12 pieces, representing the 12 tribes. 10 of the tribes are going to go under the rule of Jeroboam, and 2 tribes under the rule of Rehoboam, Judah and Benjamin. When you find this, you're going to find this is true all the way through the Bible. I keep saying, when you find something that's true, it's going to be true from one end of the Bible to the other in some figurative respect. I do not have any doubt that when the man cuts up his concubine and sends it throughout Israel, that's a picture of God scattering. How many times did God tell Israel, I will scatter you all over the earth? He starts off saying that in Deuteronomy, the 8th chapter. He says, I'm going to scatter you if you're disobedient to me. And that's what he did. The apostate woman was a picture of apostate Israel because when you get into the 12, he cuts her up and sends her throughout Israel. There is no doubt who that is. But he shall have one tribe for my servant David's sake. Well, he only gives 10. Later on, Benjamin joins with southern Judah. And for Jerusalem's sake, the city which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Zidonians, not unlike the woman, the concubine that was married to the Levite in the 19th chapter of Judges. She was apostate, went back home to her father. Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, Milcom, the god of the children of Ammon, have not walked in my ways to do that which is right in mine eyes and to keep my statutes and my judgments as did David my father. Howbeit, I will not take the whole kingdom out of David's hand, but I will make him prince all the days of his life for David my servant's sake, whom I chose because he kept my commandments and my statutes. Well, isn't that amazing? God put in it, he kept my statutes and my commandments. David committed adultery and murder. God is saying that because David was fully repentant. And I will take the kingdom out of his son's hands, and will give it unto thee, even 10 tribes. Unto his son will I give one tribe, that David my servant may have a light always before me in Jerusalem, because David's going to be his eternal king. He actually calls Jesus David in the 37th chapter of Ezekiel. The city which I have chosen me to put my name there, and I will take thee, and thou shalt reign according to all that thy soul desireth, and shall be king over Israel. And it shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee, and wilt walk in my ways, and do that is right in my sight. He's talking to Jeroboam. Jeroboam's not going to do right in his sight. To keep my commandments and as David my servant did, then will I be with thee, and build thee a sure house as I built David, and will give Israel unto thee. That sounds peculiar, God saying this to Jeroboam, who's head of the northern tribes. But he's not going to do that, because God's going to move into the heart of Jeroboam so that he will fail, because nobody but David's lineage is going to have the kingdom of Israel. And I will for this afflict the seed of David, but not forever. Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam, and Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt unto Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. And the rest of the acts of Solomon and all that he did and his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the acts of Solomon? When Jeroboam came back, he became Rehoboam's commander. And the time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years, and Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David his father, and Rehoboam his son reigned in his stead. And then Rehoboam goes in here and has his, he, this is where he takes the bad advice in this 12th chapter, And then he's stirred up to go attack Jeroboam, and God says, no, I'm behind this. Now let's go back to the 19th chapter. Now can you see what's happening in the 19th chapter of Judges? What's happening when this man cuts his concubine up and sends her throughout all Israel? We're still talking about Benjamin. And this results in Benjamin's being like a great wolf, ravening as a wolf. Now let's go back to Judges, the 20th chapter. Judges, the 20th chapter. How much time do I have?
9 minutes.
Well, I ain't going to get into this very far. All right, now. Now let's get back here. And some of these things, they're awful detailed, but they're very important. I hope you can see that. 20:1. Then all the children of Israel went out, and the congregation was gathered together as one man from Dan even to Beersheba, with the land of Gilead into the house in Mizpah. And the chief of all the people, even of all the tribes of Israel, presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 footmen that drew the sword. 400,000. They got 400,000 footmen. 400,000. This is of the 11 tribes. Because they're gathering together. They're going to attack Benjamin. We're going to see what a fighter Benjamin is. They're going to attack Benjamin. Now the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel were going up to Mizpah. Then said the children of Israel, tell us, how was this wickedness? And the Levite, the husband of the woman that was slain, answered and said, I came to Gibeah that belongs to Benjamin, I and my concubine to lodge. And the men of Gibeah rose against me and beset the house round about upon me by night, and thought to have slain me, and my concubine have they forced that she's dead. She died. They forced her sexually all night long. Just raped her all night, and then she died upon the threshold. And I took my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout all the country of the inheritance of Israel. That's why they're all gathered here. I'm sure he sent a message as well. For they have committed lewdness and folly in Israel. Behold, ye are all children of Israel. Give here your advice and counsel. And all the people arose as one man, saying, we will not any of us go to his tent, neither will we any of us turn into his house. They're making a vow before God. And now this shall be the thing which we will do to the Gibeah. We will go up by lot against it, and we will take 10 men of 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, and 100 and 100 of 1,000, and 1,000 out of 10,000 to fetch victual for the people, that they may do when they come to Gibeah of Benjamin. They're going to send out all these people to bring food, because they're going to make a siege against Gibeah. Remember the sword of the siege? They're going to make a siege against it. According to all the folly they have wrought in Israel. So all the men of Israel were gathered against the city of Gibeah, and this is in the land of Benjamin, knit together as one man. And the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what wickedness is this that is done among you? Now therefore deliver us, the men, the children of Belial, which are in Gibeah, that we may put them to death. These that did this evil deed, we're going to destroy them, that raped this woman all night, and put away evil from Israel. But the children of Benjamin said, you're not taking anybody out here. All of Israel is encamped against them. Remember, Benjamin is a raven's like a wolf. He fights like a madman. Remember I said earlier that Issachar said, I don't go to war. We're not fighters. We're farmers. They all had a different personality. Benjamin says, we will fight anybody. We'll go to war by ourselves. We'll fight all of Israel. And that's what they do. Now, you notice, Israel's got 400,000 men that bear the sword. tremendous number. But the children of Benjamin gathered themselves together out of the cities into Gibeah to go out to battle against the children of Israel. 1 against 11. It's one tribe's going to fight all the rest of Israel. This doesn't make any sense, does it? Sounds like a fight in a church, doesn't it? And the children of Benjamin were numbered at that time of the cities, 26,000 that drew the sword. 26,000. They're going to fight like a wolf. 26,000 against 400,000. That's not quite balanced, is it? Wait till the fight starts. They fight like a ravening wolf. They drew the sword beside the inhabitants of Gibeah, which were numbered 700 chosen men. So they had 700 out of Gibeah. Among all this people, there were 700 chosen men left-handed. Everyone could sling stones at a hairbreadth and not miss. You've heard me say that 100 times. Man with a sling was very dangerous. It was an excellent weapon in war. And David was proficient with a sling. He was good. When he saw that lumbering giant out there, it wasn't that God was going to do a miracle. I've said this so many times. He practiced with that sling every day. You have to use a smooth stone. He picked up 5 smooth stones. I used to make slings out of the tongues of old shoes. My father's old shoes. I'd take them out and make a sling. If you get a jagged stone, it'll go, you know, like a spitball. Except it'll worse than a spitball. It'll go every direction. You know where it's going to end up. If you get a smooth stone, it'll go straight. And David knew he could hit that giant. I can kill him. I'll hit him. He ain't going to get within in talking distance to me. He'll have to holler at me. Because I'll hit him here before. He had done that too many times before. So they could hit a hair's breadth at a distance as far as they could throw it. I've said it, Alexander the Great had companies of men with slings. When you take a sling, the longer the string, you just usually swing it one time. And when you do, you let that thing go. Man, it goes 100 miles an hour, I guess. And it's very dangerous. And the men of Israel, beside Benjamin, were numbered 400,000 men that drew the sword. All these were men of war. You got 400,000 going against 26,000 plus 700, 26,700. And the children of Israel arose and went up to the house of God and asked counsel of God and said, which of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin? Which one of us tribes? Which one of us do you want to go beat him? God wanted the entire nation, not one tribe. God says, well, go up there and do what you want. And the Lord said, Judah shall go up first. And the children of Israel rose up in the morning and encamped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin. And the men of Israel put themselves in array to fight against them at Gibeah. And the children of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and destroyed down to the ground of the Israelites that day 22,000 men. They fought like a wolf. That's what that meant when it says, Benjamin will be a ravening wolf. They killed 22,000 men. They only had 26,000. They killed nearly that many of the tribe of Judah. These guys must have been tough. They were hard fighters. They were saying, you don't tell us what to do. I don't listen to instructions. And the people, the men of Israel, encouraged themselves and set their battle again in array in the place where they put themselves in array the first day. And the children of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until even and asked counsel of the Lord, saying, shall I go up again to battle against the children of Benjamin, my brother? And the Lord said, go up against him. And the children of Israel came near against the children of Benjamin the second day, and Benjamin went forth against them out of Gibeah the second day and destroyed down to the ground of the children of Israel another 18,000. They fought like a wolf, didn't they? They killed another 18,000. And they only got 26,000 men. They're just wiping Israel off the map fast. This was a fighting tribe. They were not like Issachar. You want to fight, we'll give you one. They were bad to deal with. They fought like a wolf. They were fierce. What verse was I in? 25? Well, I don't even remember what chapter. 20. Oh, I was in verse 25. Lordy me. And Benjamin went forth against them on Gibeah the second day and destroyed down to the ground of the children 18,000. Then all the children of Israel and all the people came into the house of God and wept and sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before God and said, God, help us. We got a brother that's just ferocious. We can't conquer him. And the children of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the ark of the covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days. Shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of Benjamin, my brother? Or shall I cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into thine hand. And Israel set liers in wait. That means ambush. About Gibeah, and the children of Israel went out up against the children of Benjamin the third day, but they had to trick them because they couldn't fight them the same way they'd been fighting. They was going to get beat. These guys were just some of the best fighters there were. And put themselves in array against Gibeah as at other times, and the children of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. They drew them into a trap. They pulled them away from the city, then they come in behind them. And they get them surrounded. And they begin to smite of the people and kill as at other times in the highways, of which one goeth up to the house of God and the other to Gibeah in the field about 30 men of Israel. And the children of Benjamin said, they are smitten before us as at the first. But the children of Israel said, let us flee and draw them from the city into the highways. And all the men of Israel rose up out of their place and put themselves in array at Beltimar and liers in the wait. Or in ambush, of Israel came forth out of their places, even out of the meadows at Gibeah. And there came against Gibeah 10,000 chosen men out of Israel, and the battle was sore. But they knew not that evil was near them, and the Lord smote Benjamin. They had to go pray before the Ark of the Covenant. The Lord smote Benjamin before Israel. The children of Israel destroyed of the Benjamites that day 25,000 and 100 men, all that drew the sword, and they only had 26,000. So what do they have left? 900 men left, that's it. Whew. They sure did put up a good fight, didn't they, though? They fought like a wolf. So the children of Benjamin saw that they were smitten, for the men of Israel gave place to the Benjamites because they trusted unto the ambush. If they hadn't been ambushed, they probably wouldn't have beat them. They had to do some tricks, which they set beside Gibeah, and the liars in wait hasted and rushed upon Gibeah, and the liars in wait drew themselves along and smote all the city with the edge of the sword. And there was an appointed sign between the men of Israel and the liars in wait that they should make a great flame with smoke rise up out of the city. And when the men of Israel retired in the battle, Benjamin began to smite and kill of the men of Israel about 30 persons, for they said, surely they are smitten down before us as in the first battle. But when they turned and saw the flame, their city was burning up. When the flame began to rise out of the city with a pillar of smoke, the Benjamites looked behind them, and behold, the flame of the city ascended to heaven. Then they got scared and they started running. They said, our houses are burning down. And when the men of Israel turned again, the men of Benjamin were amazed, for they saw that the evil was come upon them. Therefore, they turned their backs before the men of Israel. They turned their backs on them and started running back to save their homes. If they hadn't done that, they probably wouldn't have beat them. One little tribe taking on the whole nation. Ooh-wee. They had to have training along the way, didn't they? Perhaps these pagans they lived with had trained them to fight. Probably. Saul was from there, and he learned how to fight from the start. I'll read down to the end of this. I'm out of time. They turned their backs before the men of Israel into the way of the wilderness, but the battle overtook them, which came out of the cities they destroyed in the midst of them. Thus they enclosed the Benjamites round about and chased them and trod them down with ease over against Gibeah towards the sun rising, and their fellow Benjamin, 18,000 men. All these were men of valor, and they turned and fled toward the wilderness into the rock of Rimmon, and they gleaned of them in the highways 5,000 men, pursued hard after them in Gidom, and slew 2,000 men. This is totaling up this total number. And that all which fell that day of Benjamin were 25,000 men that drew the sword. All these were men of valor. And they rounded it off to 25,000 here instead of saying 25,100. And 600 men turned and fled to the wilderness into the rock Rimmon, and abode in the rock Rimmon 4 months. And the men of Israel turned again upon the children of Benjamin and smote them with the edge of the sword, as well as the men of every city, as the beast that came to hand. And they all set on fire all the cities that they came to. And the next chapter is about how most of the men were killed off in Benjamin, so they have to come up and get, or most of the women are killed off, they have to get wives.
So didn't some of them practice homosexuality too?
Well, that's what's going on here. This is what they're talking about. They're putting their approval on this homosexuality. They're putting their approval on the homosexuality that these men wanted to get involved in. And then this goes into the remaining men of Benjamin that don't have any wives. It's a real funny chapter, this next chapter, about how that they get their wives. Well, I'm out of time. I hope you can see that when you get into the words hospitality and sojourners, that's what we are. And these are laws that apply to us. Well, let's pray. Father, thank you for truth. Thank you for your word. God, we pray that you'll cause us to continue this work and study this book, so we can see what your word is about, see what the rewards are about when you, what the consequences are when we apostatize from you. Teach us to continue the word and in truth. We give you praise for all things. In Christ's name, amen.